up, I was his.
So he picked you up, so he owned you.
That's right. You will do as I say. And you know what? If that man had told me to go to Alvarado and Pico and stand on my head with no panties on to stay sober, I'd have done it. Anything that man told me to do, I did.
Okay, tell me about his sponsorship. Tell me about Tex Adams.
Oh, God.
Because he started the Hole in the Ground group, and as I recall, the mother group was going to incorporate to try to shut him down.
They did incorporate.
They did.
They did incorporate.
Okay, describe a little bit about Tex Adams, about what kind of a sponsor he was, what he made you do.
Tex Adams would go to any length for people he sponsored. But he made you follow the big book. We carried our big books to meetings, and Tex used to say to us, if that sucker's talking and you don't hear, find it in the big book, he's lying. He would not let me talk past, I'm Vivian, I'm an alcoholic. If I started to open my mouth after that, and we go to podiums down south, you know, he'd say, shut up, spaghetti brain. Didn't matter how many people were there. I was not allowed to talk. I was not allowed to chair or anything until I had a year sober. And he used to always say, take the cotton out of your ears and stuff it in your mouth. You know, had a big, robust, dynamic man. He was a very spiritual man, very spiritual. The closest I ever got to anyone describing Tex was a pitch that Sybil gave. You get through here, if you've got time, I'll let you hear that tape.
Okay, this is all right. Don't pay attention to that. I just switched sides.
Oh, okay.
It does that automatically. So
but Tex was dynamic. He was so full of love. And he had such a firm, beautiful hand. But he was totally programmed. You know, one time, Bill Wilson wrote a letter about the Hole in the Ground. I'd love to get a copy of it, and I don't know where it is. About the Hole in the Ground and Tex Adams. And he said, quote, I am well aware of the Hole in the Ground and Tex Adams, and I'm glad they're both there. And I'm also very thrilled that there's only one of each of them. So you see, Tex was a terrific guy. When you sum it up, there are more people sober today in Southern California as a result of Tex Adams. And you see, there are a lot of people sober up here because I believe that when you and I do our thing or pass, whatever you want to call it, I'm going to be doing my thing. But the eternity I'm looking for is the eternity that I have given Tex. Because I don't teach anyone that I sponsor anything that my beautiful big Tex didn't teach me. So he lives on.
Sure he does.
And then when I do my thing, I will live on. Because I try to teach well. And I hope the people I sponsor will teach as well. And that means you go on and on for all eternity. We'll see.
Yeah.
AA is our eternity. It is our very life.
You bet it is.
But it is also our eternity. As much as we put into it. And I try very hard to put my all in it. I can never pay back. You see, my God reached down in a barrel of something real dirty and pulled me out. He held me up and he cleaned me off. And I think my God has a sense of humor. Because I was in terrible shape. I looked awful. when he got me cleaning me off, he looked at me and he said, "I made this," and he laughed. He laughed. And he patted me on the popo and he said, "Okay, baby, go do my work." And I'm so grateful for that today, that my God could hold on to me. My little spiritual advisor taught me something that I try to teach to my people I sponsor. See, I wanted to have a spiritual awakening like Bill Wilson had. And I prayed, and I prayed, and I prayed, and I prayed, and nothing happened. And I went to Fred, and I told him, "Fred, I'm going to get drunk because God don't want me." And he said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Vivian, when you borrowed a car..." I never stole a car in my life. I borrowed them. Remember that. "When you borrowed a car in Portland and headed for Los Angeles down Highway 101, you're too young to remember what 101 was like. But when it rained, it was there sometimes, and then sometimes it wasn't. That's the old highway." He said, "When you go down there in the winter, when it's raining, who do you think was driving that car?" He said, "When you came to in Georgia Street, Recibo, and all I've got is a scar on my elbow, but there were five other people laying dead on the pavement," he said, "who do you think took that bullet? It wasn't you. When you borrowed a car in San Francisco, and you came to in Pyramid Lake, and the windows were up and the doors were locked, you were sitting on the bank, and the car was going down, how do you think it got out?" "No." He said, "You better look at it." He said, "Those are your spiritual experiences." I said, "Yeah, but what does that have to do with me?" And he said, "Well, you'll figure it out." One day I was standing in my shower, and I figured it out. My God was never interested in anything but me. And he had walked with me, he had been with me, he had taken care of me, and I didn't even know it. And that all I had to do was say, "Here, my Lord, walk with me, I'll do the footwork, don't let me get in too much trouble, I don't want you to take care of my bank account, it's like this $75 that we were talking about. I got the notice yesterday." Lisa said, "Oh, what are we going to do?" And I said, "Something will happen. Something will happen." I didn't have to tell you that this was happening to me. You said, "Do you still want to?" You see, God works in mysterious ways. And he works with people who are his people. He manipulates them. God's a great manipulator. Great manipulator. I think maybe creates because he loves us the most. Because we are manipulators. We have a way of getting things done. And when we turn to God, we turn wholeheartedly. I hear people say, "I'd buy it back." Man, I don't dare take myself out of God's care. Almost 6 years ago now, my doctor reminded me the other day. I died. I had an out-of-body experience. I came back. They sent me home to die. They told me I was going to die in 60 days. And I wanted to die at home. They got me my hospital bed, my everything. 5 days after I got home, I went to San Jose for a pitch. My doctor doesn't stop me going anywhere. Because I told him, I've got a lot to say and a lot of people to see and a lot of places to go. And I'm going as long as I can go. I am going to carry the message. and I never refuse when anyone asks me to come. I don't care. You know, if I... Lately, I have had to have the group buy me a bed at night or find a home for me because I can't go the two directions in one time. Yeah. Because it's a big strain with all the oxygen and the traveling and everything. But you see, I have a simple prayer at night. Today is such a beautiful gift because I have been card blue twice, or nine times. 1 year I went to that hospital 17 times and came out of it every time. When God is finished with me, when I have met my last alcoholic, when I've taken a hold of their hand, and breached between them and God, then he'll let me go. But apparently, today, there's still somebody out there because I'm still here.
That's beautiful.
And at night, when I go to bed, I say, thank you, God, for this day. And every morning when I wake up, I thank him for letting me wake up. But you know, God is so good to me. So good to me. I had a rough time this weekend, a lot of stress. My favorite person that I sponsor, came up on a TDY, and he's way down by Visalia, but he had the weekend off. So he rented a car and came to see Mama. He had just gotten here and he got a phone call. And my little Teresa had had a miscarriage. And so the house went all boom, you know. I've had a rough weekend. But Danny and I have walked a lot hand in hand with God. My little Teresa is not an alcoholic. And he's been on the phone to her I don't know how many times, sent her yellow roses, and she's still crying and taking on. And was ready to kill Danny when he said, Teresa, we didn't know the baby. It didn't come to life. And the life was God's to give. Can you be grateful? You could hear a scream clear out here. He was talking in the bedroom. He said, it could have been handicapped. It could have been deformed. God knows what he was doing. God knew what he was doing. And this is a man who really walks with his program, really walks with it, to lose a child and say God knew what he was doing. You've got to have a lot of faith.
You've got to have an awful lot.
And I looked at him today and I said, Danny, I love your faith. And he said, where do you think I got it? Because when he came in, he didn't want to talk about God. And I said, do you believe I believe in him? And he said, yes. And I said, borrow mine. Borrow mine until you can believe. And then after you get to where you can believe, you can keep mine too. Because he's not expensive. All you have to do is be willing. Just willing. That's all it takes. It's like we were talking about our shortcomings. You didn't really talk about shortcomings. But some people don't know what shortcomings are. Now I try to teach my people. He will not go to a meeting if he's going to be late. Because one of his things was, you are always late. Learn to get there on time. That is a shortcoming. No, you don't go anywhere late. You have to learn what a shortcoming is in order to do anything about it. You know? It's like learning the difference in our four-step and our fifth-step. You know, there's a great difference there, if you really look at it. A great difference. And people don't see it. They don't realize that the fourth step is really the inside job. And the fifth step is the garbage you throw away. But the inside job is the one you really got to work on. Really got to work on. My fears, how can I be fearful and have faith? No way. My resentments, why do I resent? Well, it's jeopardizing my security or something. So apparently I have to watch my insecurity. I've got to work on it. I have to work on my anger, my jealousy. These are the things that make me up. These are my characters, you know. All right. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it did not perform a root canal on my emotions. So I have to keep looking at that fourth step because I can buy them back. I can find myself getting angrier each time I get angry if I don't catch the anger. Because I was an angry drunk. Never broke a bottle unless somebody got cut. Never started a fight the bar till it was wrecked. You know, I could hold a resentment for 2 years. I've done it. All these things that are me, you know, we talk about humility. When I finished my fourth step, when I finished dissecting myself, I knew what humility was, because for the first time I knew me. I knew what I was made of. I knew my personality. I knew my weaknesses and my strengths. I put down some of my strengths, but believe me, my weaknesses were greater. And my sponsor, Tex, God love him, he said, take one thing. Don't take your whole inventory at once. Find one thing that's glaring, write it on a piece of paper, pin it to your bra, and work on it. And when it gets better, then pick up another one. And then you can finish working on that one and really concentrate on the other one. But work on it. And he made me take it one thing at a time. My profanity. I came in, I was the most profane. I could make a stevedore plus. Really, I could. Well, I learned not to use profanity. I do occasionally. I don't use four-letter words. But I still remember how he told me to walk. And that's how I tell others. I was like a baby who needed bleeding. And he led me. You know. He was beautiful.
Tell me about his meetings there. When you got sober in 1946.
Yeah.
You got out and you began what you like to describe as your period of sobriety, when you were free on your own.
Yeah.
To start maintaining the sobriety.
His meetings, what were they like?
Tell me what his meeting... Describe a meeting at the Hole in the Ground for me. What took place there, as best you can recall?
Well...
Did we open with the Serenity Prayer and
no.
a moment of silence?
No.
Go ahead and describe a meeting to me.
You open with the portion of Chapter 5, how it works.
Okay, they did read that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Your chairman had better be selected the week before so they were prepared.
Okay.
You didn't pick them out of the... You know. Well, you always had to get up and go to the podium if you were called on. We discussed everything that you talked about, indecision. You know, I remember one time I had a lot of indecision. I went to a store to buy a slip, and I needed two slips, and the slips cost $25, and I couldn't decide which one I needed the most, and I stood there for an hour. And I wound up crying and left the store. Right? And so, you would discuss what happened to you. You would tell what happened to you as chairperson. Now, if there were newcomers in the meeting, you told what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. Very shortly. Then you told about what you were having problems with. And then you started talking, calling on people. And they would get up, and they would tell you what step they used to handle that. It was always into the program. It had to come out of the big book. If you were afraid, they would always come up with something that would end fear. Usually it was the third step would handle your fear. But they always found a way to work a step into a meeting. There was no traditions, you know, until 55.
55, yeah.
So, we had to go along on the big book. There wasn't all this literature that we have now, thank God. I don't know if I could get drunk if I had to read all this stuff. Get sober, I mean. You know, it's just too much.
Well, then you would open with chapter 5. The week before, you had selected a chairman.
That's right.
And then he would call the chairman after reading the chapter 5. A chairman would...
The secretary would call the chairman.
The secretary... Okay, and then he would tell what it's...
Kind of, whatever the subject was to be.
Okay, he would select the topic and the subject. And then as people were called on, they would come to the podium...
And
where did that idea of coming to the podium come from? Is that something from New York? Or
I don't know. It was always in California.
Go ahead. Anyway, do you have any idea where that coming to the podium started from?
I don't know where it started.
Okay.
It was in when I came in.
It was there in place. Mm. Okay, so then it would come up and describe what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, and then briefly... Any problem?
Now, if they talked over 5 minutes, we rang a cowbell.
You rang a cowbell.
That's right. We did not have a speakers meeting.
How long were the meetings? Were they 1 hour?
An hour and a half.
Hour and a half meeting. Mm. Okay. So then people would share that way. The chairman then would call on people.
That's right.
And then how did you close the meeting? Because I understand.
With the Lord's Prayer.
Was the Lord's Prayer already being used when you came
in? Yes.
Because I remember hearing an Al Marino tape one time, and I never got to see the man. He died on a golf course.
But mm-hmm.
He said they had a hell of a fight over getting that Lord's Prayer in there. Hitting each other over the head with chairs, you know. And
they had a hard time learning to hold hands.
Is that right?
Yeah, they said that was cultism.
Were they holding hands at the time you got there?
No.
No? Mm-mm. About when did that come in?
I had about 2 years sober. We didn't even get birthday cakes. When I was 3 years old, I was living up in Bakersfield. Tex called me and said, "Well, we're going to have a birthday cake coming down." And I said, "Yeah, I'll be there." And so I got a nice new outfit and an orchid from my husband, and he chartered a plane, and we flew down. And Tex was sitting at the top of the stairs, and he looked at me and he said, "What the hell you all got up for?" I said, "It's my birthday. I'm going to get a birthday cake." "Yeah," he said, "you're going to get a Medal of Honor for something you should have been doing all your life." And I went down and took my name off the cake. And I never received another cake until I was 27 years sober.
Just because of what he said about
that. That's right. I didn't need a Medal of Honor. And then I realized that the younger people have a right to know that you can make it this long.
You betcha. That's why it's so important to me and to a lot of us to be able
to... You know, maybe my near 40 years doesn't impress anybody, but it impresses the hell out of me because I couldn't stay sober 40 minutes.
It impresses the hell out of me because it shows me that this thing can work that long, you know. Mm-hmm. My personal experience is nowhere near that amount of time, but...
You know, I've always prayed that I could have as much time as Bill Wilson.
You
getting
got
closer.
Right.
Bill had 42, I think, didn't he? 41 or 42.
71, he had 36.
36, I beat him then.
You got him. Well then, okay, so how many meetings a week were you going to there at the Hole in the Ground?
Oh, God. I'd go to the Hole in the Ground. They had one every night. And then we'd go to a place called Jefferson. And then they opened a club called the 6300 Club. And we'd go to the 6300 Club and dance and go to meetings. And then they started opening them down in Santa Monica, and we started going down there, and they opened at Southgate, we'd go there. We would take half of our group from the hole in the ground and go anywhere. If we heard of a new meeting, Tex would say, well, now hear this. They're starting a new meeting down here, and I think we better go down and support them. So we'd take half our meeting and go to that meeting. And then there was no H&I, you know.
I want to get into that with you, because you've been very heavily involved.
Oh, yes.
For your sobriety.
That has been my vehicle of sobriety. I don't get into the politics anymore. I did it first. But it's the one place you can still carry the message.
Well, tell me about that. Share that with me. Now you.
Well,
you
we used to go into Lincoln Heights, and we had little cards printed before the traditions came into being. And they had on it Vivian R. Lanning, that was my name at the time, representative of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we'd go in and we'd give it to the head jailer. I have other names for him. Almost said it. But we'd give it to the head jailer.
You don't use four-letter words anymore.
And now nowadays... we can get in, you know, we have set meetings. But if we got a call that somebody was in there that had tried to make the program and it had a relapse, why, we would go down and try to get them out. Nine times out of ten, we did. We had two recovery houses started by that time. One of them was not the Friendly House. One of them was the Hoover House, that was started by a bunch of alcoholic women. And then they had one over on Alvarado that was started by alcoholic men. And we'd pull them out of there, take them down, clean them up, and then get them into the judge. You know, and they looked pretty good by the time they got.
You take them out of jail and
then, oh, yeah.
And go clean them up.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let me ask you this before we get into that H&I, because I know you spent a good portion of your sobriety in
there,
and you probably got a lot of things that when you and I talked on the phone about getting together. There's L.A., there's Bakersfield, and now there's Sacramento and the Vacaville area. Describe your first 12-step call to me. Do you remember your first 12-step call?
That I went on.
That you went on.
Very vividly. It was a man.
Okay.
And my sponsor said to me, I am going on a 12-step call. You are going with me. Bring your big book. Now he said, we're going to knock on the door. And I'm going into that meeting with God and the big book. And you are going to keep your mouth shut. You are going to learn how to make a 12-step call. And that was my first 12-step call. I went in, and I shut my mouth, and I listened. Then he taught us to try to get somebody who would take the wife or the husband, whoever was the non-drinker, into the other room. Or to get the children out into the yard. Somebody who could work with us. We had quite a working thing going. Everybody worked together. And the end result was the alcoholic. We never asked him, like they do, well, do you want to go to a meeting tonight? First thing, we at the end would ask them if they'd like to go. But we'd go in and we'd tell them, hi, I'm Vivian, I'm an alcoholic. Let me tell you what happened to me. And that's exactly what we'd do. We'd go by the big book. We would put out the identification before we asked them to identify with us. Nowadays, they're saying, you think you're an alcoholic? Well, you know, that wasn't the way I was taught. I was taught to go in and let them try to find similarities with me, and then say, do you think you're one of us? Do you think you might have a problem? Would you like to go to a meeting? It was that simple. We had nothing to go on but our big book, God, and ourselves.
Okay, now how did, going back and kind of hypothetically, how did Tex get that call that he took you on?
Well, by that time...
You didn't have a central office, did you?
No, but they had a system of calling. I don't remember what it was.
Maybe like advertisements in the paper and call this number, which might be the hole in the ground or something, and somebody would get the information.
And Sybil was handling them for a long time.
Yeah, she worked central service.
Well, she went into central office after she got... I want you to hear this tape before you leave, because it's fabulous.
Okay, I want to hear that.
You'll learn a lot about Tex from that. You may even want to put on your tape how he taught the 12 steps, because it was beautiful. And we all learned it the same way. But we, I don't know, that was the only way we knew. I guess our stupidity made it a good approach. We didn't know anything to do but to tell them our way.
An awful lot to give the people down the road. And what you're talking about anyway on a 12-step thing was what the book said to do. That's Sherry and our experience.
That's right.
To provide the identification. Okay, now, the guy, I've heard old-timers say, well, the first thing you ask them, do you want to get sober? Second thing you ask them is, do you believe in God? Third thing you ask them is, are you willing to ask God for help? Now that's, I don't know if that was Clarence Snyder or what, you know, that may have come up with that, you know. Of course, he was an old rebel, we all know that.
Mm-hmm.
And you much better than I.
I knew Clarence very well, Bigfoot.
I just know him from tapes. But okay, so what you would ask him then after you've told your story to allow this process of identification to take place, do you want to go to a meeting? Is that what you would ask him? Would you like to go with us to a meeting?
No, we would ask him, now has alcohol given you any troubles like it's given me?
Okay.
You know, have you gone through some of the things I went through? Would you like to go to a meeting and find out more about Alcoholics Anonymous? That's simple.
And then he says, yeah, then what would you do?
Suppose we'd take him to a meeting.
Were there enough meetings to go to at that time?
Yeah, we'd find one.
You'd find one. By 46, you should have quite a few meetings going on.
Yeah, they had quite a few going on. But if we had to get a meeting together for the sucker, we would. You know, we'd call 8 or 10 people and say, well, we'll meet at Sib's house, or we'll meet at Emil and Vivian's house, or come on, let's go, you know. You'd get a bunch of Alkies together to give him a message.
Okay, now service comes in two forms. There's the service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, trustees, delegates, and the sort of thing I'm involved in.
Yeah.
But I'm not elected. I'm appointed by the committee. And then there's the other sort of service. What did they have you do as far as the cups and the meeting room and all of that stuff? You know, that a lot of people consider service.
They kept you sober that way. They made you responsible. See, we don't have donuts anymore, and I miss them.
Yeah.
But we used to get donuts for cut rate, you know, stale donuts.
Day old or something.
And if we saw somebody that was having a hard time, we gave them the keys and said, you make the coffee and get the donuts. And they had to open the door.
So they would be responsible for being there on time.
They would be responsible for getting that door open. Then we had other people that, well, Tex had a favorite saying, give that guy a broom, he's shaking, he can stand still and we'll sweep the floor, you know. Get them active right now. Make them feel like they belong right now. Of course, we didn't have styrofoam cups either. So the cups had to be washed. And so somebody like Chuck Chamberlain, do you know that right up until the end, Chuck Chamberlain washed the cups at Laguna Beach?
Is that right?
That's right. Because when Chuck Chamberlain came in, by God, we made him wash cups. He thought he was so much, we said, we'll show him and his intellect.
So you were there when Chuck came in?
Yeah.
He must have come in about 47,
yeah.
48, somewhere.
48,
yeah.
I think.
I'll be darned. Yeah. So to level his yeah. pride and his arrogance a little bit.
And then I was there when God came in, too.
Clancy?
Yeah.
Oh, I erase that off of the tape. Cause, anyway, so how many people would be there that they'd have to wash cups for?
Maybe 30 or 40.
Well, it wasn't going to kill them, right?
No.
Okay, well then, that's the type of service. It was get involved, be part of.
Clean the one guy, don't do it all. You clean the ashtrays, you wash cups, you see that the coffee's made, you sweep.
And keep your mouth shut for a year.
Keep your mouth shut for
you
a year.
You give your name and the nature of your disease or something like
that's
that.
That's right.
And then, okay.
Shut up.
Now. Don't let me forget, I want to ask you about Bill Wilson, but you met him later, and I'm trying to take this chronologically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you met him again later.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, then you started getting into the H&I with the Lincoln...
Heights. It wasn't H&I, though.
Okay, but it was going in there.
We were going into there, and we were going into Stockton, and we were going in... Not Stockton. The mental hospitals down south, anyway. And we went into the government jail out at Terminal Island. And we went into a juvenile hall way back then.
Yeah, but it wasn't H&I. What was it?
Well...
You mean it wasn't an H&I?
It wasn't like it is now. What it was, each group would have a week and a month. And we had to stop that. Because they got to where we were going into penitentiaries, like up here at San Quentin. And two groups would meet, you know, at one time. And you have to go up a hill to get to the penitentiary. You parked down, you know. And they'd get into fist fights.
Over
whose night it was. And so we had to do something about it. And the committee was formed.
That's how H&I came into being?
That's how H&I came into
being. Would that have been around 48, 49, somewhere around in there? I know that the H&I has their own archives, but to the best of your memory.
'51 or '52.
Okay. So then that's kind of why that area of service kind of came to be a separate thing as opposed to... The rest of the country now, service is service and includes H&I.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in the state of California, correct me if I'm wrong, that H&I started before there was a service structure.
That's right.
Even though in 1951 we had our first General Service Conference,
mm-hmm.
that H&I actually preceded.
Mm-hmm.
And they got organized so that you could have a committee that would say, Joe, Bill, and Tom will go to San Quentin mm-hmm. and handle the panels there, so mm-hmm. that we got away from that.
That's right. Under the bridge, drinking, except I was out of drinks.
Sacramento?
In Lodi.
Lodi.
It's the other side of Sacramento. And this other stumble bum comes in, and he's got a jug, a whole gallon jug. I wanted some of his jug. And he said, we got to eat something. And I said, like what? And he said, oh, pickled pig's feet or pickled eggs or something. And so I crawled up the bank, and there was a bar right on the bank. And I went into the sandbox. When I came out, I picked up a gallon jug of pickled pig's feet and kept on walking. And Wino and I drank wine and ate pig's feet till we were both sick. We were both sick. And I had forgotten about that for a lot of years until I went to a meeting at the Rogue Roundup. And Wino Joe was speaking there. And we kept talking and kept talking, and he said, "Hey, you're Lanning, aren't you?" See, a lot of people, they're hinting, and I put on so much weight. And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Don't you remember when we got drunk under Lodi Bridge? And it all started like a kaleidoscope, you know, these things come back to you. All you need is a little jar, and all of a sudden you remember." And here was Wino Joe and me under the bridge again with a jug. And we had a hellacious 2 days, Joe and I. We laughed and kidded, and we talked about protected alcoholics, the women who are coming into AA, you know, that they get locked in a clothes closet, and their husband pours their booze into them through a straw, through the keyhole, and all these kind of things. We really had people going around there. We say, "You gotta learn how to drink. Gotta learn how to drink." I love his umbrella. You know, that wine hit the bottom and it opened up like an umbrella. And he felt good. Oh, I love that man. The man from Tyler, Texas.
Yeah, you betcha. You betcha.
He is beautiful.
One of my absolute favorites to listen to. Of course, that's my hometown. It may have something to do with it.
Tyler, Texas, huh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't like Texas.
It's a good place to be from.
They put me in their penitentiary. You know, I was in Goree for 8 months.
For what?
Well, I had a borrowed car. And they arrested me in a little town called Gooseneck Creek. It's in Baytown, but the jail is in Gooseneck Creek. And they put me in jail. Now in Texas, in those days, if you had a bottle in, they took it away from you, and it wasn't cracked. When they booted you in the morning, they gave you back your bottle, right? Well, they put me in that filthy cell, and I don't think they ever arrested women down there, because there was mildewed stuff under it. It had no mattress. It was, I know they brought it across the border from Mexico. You know, these round iron things you laid on, and if you had a jacket, you put it under your head. And there were roaches in there. It was terrible. So I got out the next morning, and I said, "Didn't I have a bottle?" And they said, "Yeah, but you're not getting it." And that made me mad. So I went out, and I looked for my borrowed car. I don't know how long, but I found it. And they had three little steps, a revolving door, and they had just... It's in the days when they were beginning to get glass brick fronts. And this little brick jailhouse had torn out the front of their building and put in these beautiful glass bricks. And I drove up those three steps, through those glass bricks, up to the sergeant and said, "Now will you give me my goddamn bottle?" And they locked me up because I had damaged state property. And then on top of it, when they booted me out of Goree, they told me to get out of Texas. And I didn't ask those suckers to let me stay there in the first place. You know? So instead of getting out of Texas, you know, they would treat me like they were treated the colored people. Don't let the sun set on your, you know, just get going. So instead of getting out of Texas, I go to Houston. And they tell me about this cop. He's away on Skid Row in Houston, and he wears gloves, kid gloves, and he loves to beat up on women alcoholics on Skid Row. Well, Cerie, let me tell you that I didn't know judo for nothing, and I didn't know how to use my knees for nothing, and so when somebody came up and said, "Schweitzer's back for his vacation," I said, "Let me at him." And I got at him, and I got put in jail. And what they did there is that